His father had owned a stationery store in Stanton. Changing times had ended the business, and a hernia had ended Peter Keating Sr. 12 years ago. Louisa Keating had been left with the home that stood at the end of a respectable street, an annuity from an insurance kept up accurately, she had seen to that, and her son. The annuity was a modest one, but with the help of the boarders and of a tenacious purpose, Mrs. Keating had managed. In the summers, her son helped, clerking in hotels or posing for hat advertisements. Her son, Mrs. Keating had decided, would assume his rightful place in the world, and she had clung to this as softly, as inexorably as a leech. It's funny, Keating remembered. At one time he had wanted to be an artist. It was his mother who had chosen a better field in which to exercise his talent for drawing. Architecture, she had said, is such a respectable profession. Besides, you meet the best people in it. She had pushed him into his career. He had never known when or how. It's funny, thought Keating. He had not remembered that youthful ambition of his for years. It's funny that it should hurt him now to remember. Well, this was the night to remember it and to forget it forever. Architects, he thought, always made brilliant careers. And once on top, did they ever fail? Suddenly he recalled Henry Cameron, builder of skyscrapers 20 years ago, old drunkard with offices on some waterfront today. Keating shuddered and walked faster. He wondered, as he walked, whether people were looking at him. He watched the rectangles of lighted windows. When a curtain fluttered and a head leaned out, he tried to guess whether it had leaned to watch his passing. If it hadn't, someday it would. Someday they all would. Howard Rourke was sitting on the porch steps when Keating approached the house. He was leaning back against the steps, propped up on his elbows, his long legs stretched out. A morning glory climbed over the porch pillars as a curtain between the house and the light of a lamppost on the corner. It was strange to see an electric globe in the air of a spring night. It made the street darker and softer. It hung alone like a gap and left nothing to be seen but a few branches heavy with leaves standing still at the gap's edges. The small hint became immense, as if the darkness held nothing but a flood of leaves. The mechanical ball of glass made the leaves seem more living. It took away their color and gave the promise that in daylight they would be a brighter green than had ever existed. It took away one's sight and left a new sense instead, neither smell nor touch, yet both, a sense of spring and space. Keating stopped when he recognized the preposterous orange hair in the darkness of the porch. It was the one person whom he had wanted to see tonight. He was glad to find Rourke alone and a little afraid of it. "Congratulations, Peter," said Rourke. Oh, thanks. Keating was surprised to find that he felt more pleasure than from any other compliment he had received today. He was timidly glad that Rourke approved, and he called himself inwardly a fool for it. "I mean, do you know, or," he added sharply, "has Mother been telling you?"
"She has."
"She shouldn't have."
"Why not?"
"Look, Howard, you know that I'm terribly sorry about your being..." Rourke threw his head back and looked up at him.
"Forget it," said Rourke.
There's something I want to speak to you about, Howard, to ask your advice. Mind if I sit down?"
"What is it?"
Keating sat down on the steps beside him. There was no part that he could ever play in Rourke's presence. Besides, he did not feel like playing a part now. He heard a leaf rustling in its fall to the earth. It was a thin, glassy spring sound. He knew for the moment that he felt affection for Rourke, an affection that held pain, astonishment, and helplessness. "You won't think," said Keating gently, in complete sincerity, that it's awful of me to be asking about my business when you've just been...
I said forget about that. What is it?
You know, said Keating, honestly and unexpectedly even to himself, I've often thought that you're crazy, but I know that you know many things about it, architecture, I mean, which those fools never knew, and I know that you love it as they never will.
Well?
Well, I don't know why I should come to you, but... Howard, I've never said it before, but you see, I'd rather have your opinion on things than the dean's. I'd probably follow the dean's, but it's just that yours means more to me myself. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm saying this either.
Rourke turned over on his side, looked at him, and laughed.
It was a young, kind, friendly laughter, a thing so rare to hear from Rourke that Keating felt as if someone had taken his hand in reassurance, and he forgot that he had a party in Boston waiting for him.
Come on, said Rourke. You're not being afraid of me, are you? What do you want to ask about?
It's about my scholarship. The Paris prize I got?
Yes.
It's for 4 years. But on the other hand, Guy Francon offered me a job with him some time ago. Today he said it's still open, and I don't know which to take.
Rourke looked at him. Rourke's fingers moved in slow rotation, beating against the steps. If you want my advice, Peter, he said at last, you've made a mistake already, by asking me, by asking anyone. Never ask people. Not about your work. Don't you know what you want? How can you stand it not to know?
You see, that's what I admire about you, Howard. You always know.
Drop the compliments.
But I mean it. How do you always manage to decide?
How can you let others decide for you?
But you see, I'm not sure, Howard. I'm never sure of myself. I don't know whether I'm as good as they all tell me I am. I wouldn't admit that to anyone but you. I think it's because you're always so sure that I...
Petey!
Mrs. Keating's voice exploded behind them.
Petey, sweetheart, what are you doing there?
She stood in the doorway, in her best dress of burgundy taffeta, happy and angry.
And here I've been, sitting all alone, waiting for you. What on earth are you doing on those filthy steps in your dress suit? Get up this minute. Come on in the house, boys. I've got hot chocolate and cookies ready for you.
But, Mother, I wanted to speak to Howard about something important, said Keating. But he rose to his feet. She seemed not to have heard. She walked into the house. Keating followed.
Rourke looked after them, shrugged, rose, and went in also. Mrs. Keating settled down in an armchair, her stiff skirt crackling.
Well, she asked, what were you two discussing out there?
Keating fingered an ashtray, picked up a matchbox and dropped it, then, ignoring her, turned to Rourke.
Look, Howard, drop the pose, he said, his voice high. Shall I junk the scholarship and go to work, or let Francon wait and grab the Beaux-Arts to impress the yokels? What do you think?
Something was gone. The one moment was lost.
Now, Petey, let me get this straight, began Mrs. Keating.
Oh, wait a minute, Mother. Howard, I've got to weigh it carefully. It isn't everyone who can get a scholarship like that. You're pretty good when you rate that. A course at the Beaux-Arts? You know how important that is.
I don't, said Rourke.
Oh, hell, I know your crazy ideas, but I'm speaking practically for a man in my position. Ideals aside for a moment, it certainly is.
You don't want my advice, said Rourke.
Of course I do. I'm asking you.
But Keating could never be the same when he had an audience, any audience. Something was gone. He did not know it, but he felt that Rourke knew. Rourke's eyes made him uncomfortable, and that made him angry.
I want to practice architecture, snapped Keating. Not talk about it? Gives you a great prestige, the old école. Puts you above the rank and file of the ex-plumbers who think they can build. On the other hand, an opening with Francon, Guy Francon himself offering it.
Rourke turned away.
How many boys will match that? Keating went on blindly. A year from now, they'll be boasting they're working for Smith or Jones if they find work at all, while I'll be with Francon and Hare.
You're quite right, Peter, said Mrs. Keating, rising. On a question like that, you don't want to consult your mother. It's too important. I'll leave you to settle it with Mr. Rourke.
He looked at his mother. He did not want to hear what she thought of this. He knew that his only chance to decide was to make the decision before he heard her. She had stopped, looking at him, ready to turn and leave the room. He knew it was not a pose. She would leave if he wished it. He wanted her to go. He wanted it desperately. He said,
Why, Mother, how can you think that? Of course I want your opinion. What do you think?
She ignored the raw irritation in his voice. She smiled.
Petey, I never think anything. It's up to you. It's always been up to you.
Well, he began hesitantly, watching her. If I go to the Beaux-Arts...
Fine, said Mrs. Keating. Go to the Beaux-Arts. It's a grand place, a whole ocean away from your home. Of course, if you go, Mr. Francon will take somebody else. People will talk about that. Everybody knows that Mr. Francon picks out the best boy from Stanton every year for his office. I wonder how it'll look if some other boy gets the job, but I guess that doesn't matter.
What will people say?
Nothing much, I guess. Only that the other boy was the best man of his class. I guess he'll take Schlinker.
No, he gulped furiously. Not Schlinker.
Yes, she said sweetly. Schlinker.
But
why should you care what people will say? All you have to do is please yourself.
And you think that Francon...
Why should I think of Mr. Francon? It's nothing to me.
Mother, you want me to take the job with Francon?
I don't want anything, Petey. You're the boss.
He wondered whether he really liked his mother. But she was his mother, and this fact was recognized by everybody as meaning automatically that he loved her, and so he took for granted that whatever he felt for her was love. He did not know whether there was any reason why he should respect her judgment. She was his mother. This was supposed to take the place of reasons.
Yes, of course, Mother. But... Yes, I know. But... Howard?
It was a plea for help. Rourke was there, on a davenport in the corner, half lying, sprawled limply like a kitten. It had often astonished Keating. He had seen Rourke moving with the soundless tension, the control, the precision of a cat. He had seen him relaxed like a cat, in shapeless ease, as if his body had held no single solid bone. Rourke glanced up at him. He said,
Peter, you know how I feel about either one of your opportunities. Take your choice of the lesser evil. What will you learn at the Beaux-Arts? Only more Renaissance palaces and operetta settings. They'll kill everything you might have in you. You do good work once in a while when somebody lets you. If you really want to learn, go to work. Francon is a bastard and a fool, but you will be building. It will prepare you for going on your own that much sooner.
Even Mr. Rourke can talk sense sometimes, said Mrs. Keating. Even if he does talk like a truck driver.
Do you really think that I do good work?
Keating looked at him,
as if his eyes still held the reflection of that one sentence, and nothing else mattered. "Occasionally," said Rourke. "Not often."
"Now that it's all settled," began Mrs. Keating.
I'll have to think it over, Mother."
"Now that it's all settled, how about the hot chocolate? I'll have it out to you in a jiffy."
She smiled at her son, an innocent smile that declared her obedience and gratitude, and she rustled out of the room. Keating paced nervously, stopped, lighted a cigarette, stood spitting the smoke out in short jerks, then looked at Howard.
"What are you going to do now, Howard?"
"I? Very thoughtless of me, I know, going on like that about myself. Mother means well, but she drives me crazy. Well, to hell with that. What are you going to do?"
"I'm going to New York."
"Oh, swell. To get a job?"
"To get a job."
In architecture?"
"In architecture, Peter."
"That's grand. I'm glad. Got any definite prospects?"
"I'm going to work for Henry Cameron."
"Oh, no, Howard."
Rourke smiled slowly, the corners of his mouth sharp, and said nothing.
"Oh, no, Howard."
"Yes."
"But he's nothing nobody anymore." "Oh, I know he has a name, but he's done for. He never gets any important buildings, hasn't had any for years. They say he's got a dump for an office. What kind of future will you get out of him? What will you learn?"
"Not much. Only how to build."
"For God's sake, you can't go on like that, deliberately ruining yourself. I thought you'd learned something today."
"I have."
"Look, Howard, if it's because you think that no one else will have you now, no one better, why, I'll help you. I'll work old Frank on and I'll get connections and—"
"Thank you, Peter. But it won't be necessary. It's settled."
"What did he say?"
"Who?"
"Cameron."
"I've never met him."
Then a horn screamed outside. Keating remembered, started off to change his clothes, collided with his mother at the door, and knocked a cup off her loaded tray.
"Petey!"
"Never mind, Mother."
He seized her elbows.
"I'm in a hurry, sweetheart. A little party with the boys. Now, now, don't say anything. I won't be late. And look, we'll celebrate my going with Frank on and Hare."
He kissed her impulsively with the gay exuberance that made him irresistible at times and flew out of the room up the stairs. Mrs. Keating shook her head, flustered, reproving, and happy. In his room, while flinging his clothes in all directions, Keating thought suddenly of a wire he would send to New York. That particular subject had not been in his mind all day, but it came to him with a sense of desperate urgency. He wanted to send that wire now, at once. He scribbled it down on a piece of paper. "Katie dearest, coming New York, job Frank on, love ever, Peter." That night, Keating raced toward Boston, wedged in between two boys, the wind and the road whistling past him. And he thought that the world was opening to him now, like the darkness fleeing before the bobbing headlights. He was free. He was ready. In a few years, so very soon, for time did not exist in the speed of that car, his name would ring like a horn, ripping people out of sleep. He was ready to do great things, magnificent things, things unsurpassed in architecture. Chapter 3. Peter Keating looked at the streets of New York. The people, he observed, were extremely well-dressed. He had stopped for a moment before the building on Fifth Avenue where the office of Francon and Hare and his first day of work awaited him. He looked at the men who hurried past. Smart, he thought, smart as hell. He glanced regretfully at his own clothes. He had a great deal to learn in New York. When he could delay it no longer, he turned to the door. It was a miniature Doric portico, every inch of it scaled down to the exact proportions decreed by the artists who had worn flowing Grecian tunics. Between the marble perfection of the columns, a revolving door sparkled with nickel plate, reflecting the streaks of automobiles flying past. Keating walked through the revolving door, through the lustrous marble lobby, to an elevator of gilt and red lacquer that brought him 30 floors later to a mahogany door. He saw a slender brass plate with delicate letters. Francon and Hare, Architects. The reception room of the office of Francon and Hare, Architects, looked like a cool, intimate ballroom in a colonial mansion. The silver-white walls were paneled with flat pilasters. The pilasters were fluted and carved into Ionic snails. They supported little pediments broken in the middle to make room for half a Grecian urn plastered against the wall. Etchings of Greek temples adorned the panels, too small to be distinguished, but presenting the unmistakable columns, pediments, and crumbling stone. Quite incongruously, Keating felt as if a conveyor belt was under his feet from the moment he entered the threshold. It carried him to the reception clerk, who sat at a telephone switchboard behind the white balustrade of a Florentine balcony. It transferred him to the threshold of a huge drafting room. He saw long, flat tables, a forest of twisted rods descending from the ceiling to end in green-shaded lamps, enormous blueprint files, towers of yellow drawers, papers, tin boxes, sample bricks, pots of glue, and calendars from construction companies, most of them bearing pictures of naked women. The chief draftsman snapped at Keating without quite seeing him. He was bored and crackling with purpose simultaneously. He jerked his thumb in the direction of a locker room, thrust his chin out toward the door of a locker, and stood rocking from heels to toes while Keating pulled a pearl-gray smock over his stiff, uncertain body. Francon had insisted on that smock. The conveyor belt stopped at a table in a corner of the drafting room, where Keating found himself with a set of plans to expand, the scraggy back of the chief draftsman retreating from him in the unmistakable manner of having forgotten his existence. Keating bent over his task at once, his eyes fixed, his throat rigid. He saw nothing but the pearly shimmer of the paper before him. The steady lines he drew surprised him, for he felt certain that his hand was jerking an inch back and forth across the sheet. He followed the lines, not knowing where they led or why. He knew only that the plan was someone's tremendous achievement, which he could neither question nor equal. He wondered why he had ever thought of himself as a potential architect. Much later, he noticed the wrinkles of a gray smock sticking to a pair of shoulder blades over the next table. He glanced about him, cautiously at first, then with curiosity, then with pleasure, then with contempt. When he reached this last, Peter Keating became himself again and felt love for mankind. He noticed sallow cheeks, a funny nose, a wart on a receding chin, a stomach squashed against the edge of a table. He loved these sights. What these could do, he could do better. He smiled. Peter Keating needed his fellow men. When he glanced at his plans again, he noticed the flaws glaring at him from the masterpiece. It was the floor of a private residence, and he noted the twisted hallways that sliced great hunks of space for no apparent reason, the long rectangular sausages of rooms doomed to darkness. Jesus, he thought, they'd have flunked me for this in the first term. After which, he proceeded with his work swiftly, easily, expertly, and happily. Before lunchtime, Keating had made friends in the room, not any definite friends, but a vague soil spread and ready from which friendship would spring. He had smiled at his neighbors and winked in understanding over nothing at all. He had used each trip to the water cooler to caress those he passed with the soft, cheering glow of his eyes, the brilliant eyes that seemed to pick each man in turn out of the room, out of the universe, as the most important specimen of humanity and as Keating's dearest friend. There goes, there seemed to be left in his wake, a smart boy and a hell of a good fellow. Keating noticed that a tall, blonde youth at the next table was doing the elevation of an office building. Keating leaned with chummy respect against the boy's shoulder and looked at the laurel garlands entwined about fluted columns 3 floors high. "Pretty good for the old man," said Keating with admiration. "Who?" asked the boy. "Why, Francon," said Keating. "Francon, hell," said the boy placidly. "He hasn't designed a doghouse in 8 years." He jerked his thumb over his shoulder at a glass door behind them. "Him." "What?" asked Keating, turning. "Him," said the boy. "Stengel. He does all these things." Behind the glass door, Keating saw a pair of bony shoulders above the edge of a desk, a small triangular head bent intently, and 2 blank pools of light in the round frames of glasses. It was late in the afternoon when a presence seemed to have passed beyond the closed door, and Keating learned from the rustle of whispers around him that Guy Francon had arrived and had risen to his office on the floor above. Half an hour later, the glass door opened and Stengel came out, a huge piece of cardboard dangling between his fingers. "Hey, you," he said, his glasses stopping on Keating's face. "You doing the plans for this?" He swung the cardboard forward. "Take this up to the boss for the okay. Try to listen to what he'll say and try to look intelligent, neither of which matters anyway." He was short, and his arms seemed to hang down to his ankles, arms swinging like ropes in the long sleeves with big, efficient hands. Keating's eyes froze, darkening for 1/10 of a second, gathered in a tight stare at the blank lenses. Then Keating smiled and said pleasantly, "Yes, sir." He carried the cardboard on the tips of his 10 fingers up the crimson plushed stairway to Guy Francon's office. The cardboard displayed a watercolor perspective of a gray granite mansion with 3 tiers of dormers, 5 balconies, 4 bays, 12 columns, 1 flagpole, and 2 lions at the entrance. In the corner, neatly printed by hand, stood "Residence of Mr. and Mrs. James S. Wattles, Francon and Hare, Architects." Keating whistled softly. James S. Wattles was the multimillionaire manufacturer of shaving lotions. Guy Francon's office was polished. No, thought Keating, not polished, but shellacked. No, not shellacked, but liquid, with mirrors melted and poured over every object. He saw splinters of his own reflection let loose like a swarm of butterflies following him across the room, on the Chippendale cabinets, on the Jacobean chairs, on the Louis XV mantelpiece. He had time to note a genuine Roman statue in a corner, sepia photographs of the Parthenon, of Rheims Cathedral, of Versailles, and of the Frink National Bank building with the eternal torch. He saw his own legs approaching him in the side of the massive mahogany desk. Guy Francon sat behind the desk. Guy Francon's face was yellow and his cheeks sagged. He looked at Keating for an instant as if he had never seen him before, then remembered and smiled expansively. "Well, well, well, Kittredge, my boy, here we are, all set and at home. So glad to see you. Sit down, boy, sit down. What have you got there? Well, there's no hurry, no hurry at all. Sit down. How do you like it here?" "I'm afraid, sir, that I'm a little too happy," said Keating, with an expression of frank, boyish helplessness. "I thought I could be businesslike on my first job, but starting in a place like this, I guess it knocked me out a little. I'll get over it, sir," he promised. "Of course," said Guy Francon. "It might be a bit overwhelming for a boy, just a bit, but don't you worry. I'm sure you'll make good." "I'll do my best, sir." "Of course you will." "What's this they sent me?" Francon extended his hand to the drawing, but his fingers came to rest limply on his forehead instead.
It's so annoying, this headache.
No, no, nothing serious. He smiled at Keating's prompt concern. Just a little mal de tête. One works so hard.
Is there anything I can get for you, sir?
No, no, thank you. It's not anything you can get for me. It's if only you could take something away from me. He winked. The champagne. Entre nous, that champagne of theirs wasn't worth a damn last night. I've never cared for champagne anyway. Let me tell you, Kittredge, it's very important to know about wines. For instance, when you'll take a client out to dinner and will want to be sure of the proper thing to order. Now, I'll tell you a professional secret. Take quail, for instance. Now, most people would order burgundy with it. What do? You call for Clos Vougeot 1904, see? Adds that certain touch. Correct, but original. One must always be original. Who sent you up, by the way?
Mr. Stengel, sir.
Oh, Stengel. The tone in which he pronounced the name clicked like a shutter in Keating's mind. It was a permission to be stored away for future use.
Too grand to bring his own stuff up, eh?
Mind you, he's a great designer, the best designer in New York City, but he's just getting to be a bit too grand lately. He thinks he's the only one doing any work around here, just because I give him ideas and let him work them out for me, just because he smudges at a board all day long. You'll learn, my boy, when you've been in the business longer, that the real work of an office is done beyond its walls. Take last night, for instance. Banquet of the Clarion Real Estate Association. 200 guests. Dinner and champagne. Oh, yes, champagne. He wrinkled his nose fastidiously in self-mockery. A few words to say informally in a little after-dinner speech. You know, nothing blatant, no vulgar sales talk. Only a few well-chosen thoughts on the responsibility of realtors to society, on the importance of selecting architects who are competent, respected, and well-established. You know, a few bright little slogans that will stick in the mind.
Yes, sir. Like, choose the builder of your home as carefully as you choose the bride to inhabit it.
Not bad. Not bad at all, Kittredge. Mind if I jot it down?
My name is Keating, sir, said Keating firmly. You are very welcome to the idea. I'm happy if it appeals to you.
Keating, of course. Why, of course, Keating, said Francon with a disarming smile. Dear me, one meets so many people. How did you say it? Choose the builder. It was very well put.
He made Keating repeat it and wrote it down on a pad, picking a pencil from an array before him, new, many-colored pencils, sharpened to a professional needlepoint, ready, unused. Then he pushed the pad aside, sighed, patted the smooth waves of his hair, and said wearily,
"Well, all right, I suppose I'll have to look at the thing."
Keating extended the drawing respectfully. Francon leaned back, held the cardboard out at arm's length, and looked at it. He closed his left eye, then his right eye, then moved the cardboard an inch farther. Keating expected wildly to see him turn the drawing upside down, but Francon just held it, and Keating knew suddenly that he had long since stopped seeing it. Francon was studying it for his, Keating's, benefit, and then Keating felt light, light as air, and he saw the road to his future, clear and open.
Yes, Francon was saying, rubbing his chin with the tips of two soft fingers.
Yes, he turned to Keating.
Not bad, said Francon. Not bad at all. Well, perhaps it
could have been more distinguished, you know, but, well, the drawing is done so neatly. What do you think, Keating? Keating thought that four of the windows faced four mammoth granite columns, but he looked at Francon's fingers playing with a petunia mauve necktie and decided not to mention it. He said instead, "If I may make a suggestion, sir, it seems to me that the cartouches between the fourth and fifth floors are somewhat too modest for so imposing a building. It would appear that an ornamented string course would be so much more appropriate." "That's it. I was just going to say it. An ornamented string course. But look, it would mean diminishing the fenestration, wouldn't it?"
"Yes," said Keating, a faint coating of diffidence over the tone he had used in discussions with his classmates.
"But windows are less important than the dignity of a building's facade."
"That's right. Dignity. We must give our clients dignity above all. Yes, definitely an ornamented string course. Only, look, I've approved the preliminary drawings, and Stengel has had this done up so neatly.
Mr. Stengel will be delighted to change it if you advise him to." Francon's eyes held Keating's for a moment. Then Francon's lashes dropped, and he picked a piece of lint off his sleeve.
Of course," he said vaguely. "But do you think the string course is really important?"
"I think," said Keating slowly, "it is more important to make changes you find necessary than to okay every drawing just as Mr. Stengel designed it." Because Francon said nothing but only looked straight at him, because Francon's eyes were focused and his hands limp, Keating knew that he had taken a terrible chance and won. He became frightened by the chance after he knew he had won. They looked silently across the desk, and both saw that they were two men who could understand each other.
"We'll have an ornamented string course," said Francon with calm, genuine authority.
"Leave this here. Tell Stengel that I want to see him." He had turned to go. Francon stopped him. Francon's voice was gay and warm.
"Oh, Keating, by the way, may I make a suggestion? Just between us, no offense intended, but a burgundy necktie would be so much better than blue with your gray smock, don't you think so?"
"Yes, sir," said Keating easily. "Thank you. You'll see it tomorrow." He walked out and closed the door softly. On his way back through the reception room, Keating saw a distinguished gray-haired gentleman escorting a lady to the door. The gentleman wore no hat and obviously belonged to the office. The lady wore a mink cape and was obviously a client. The gentleman was not bowing to the ground. He was not unrolling a carpet. He was not waving a fan over her head. He was only holding the door for her. It merely seemed to Keating that the gentleman was doing all of that. The Frink National Bank building rose over Lower Manhattan, and its long shadow moved as the sun traveled over the sky like a huge clock hand across grimy tenements from the aquarium to Manhattan Bridge. When the sun was gone, the torch of Hadrian's mausoleum flared up in its stead and made glowing red smears on the glass of windows for miles around, on the top stories of buildings high enough to reflect it. The Frink National Bank building displayed the entire history of Roman art in well-chosen specimens. For a long time, it had been considered the best building of the city, because no other structure could boast a single classical item which it did not possess. It offered so many columns, pediments, friezes, tripods, gladiators, urns, and volutes that it looked as if it had not been built of white marble, but squeezed out of a pastry tube. It was, however, built of white marble.
No one knew that but the owners who had paid for it. It was now of a streaked, blotched, leprous color, neither brown nor green, but the worst tones of both, the color of slow rot, the color of smoke, gas fumes, and acids eating into a delicate stone intended for clean air and open country. The Frink National Bank building, however, was a great success. It had been so great a success that it was the last structure Guy Francon ever designed. Its prestige spared him the bother from then on. 3 blocks east of the Frink National Bank stood the Dana building. It was some stories lower and without any prestige whatever. Its lines were hard and simple, revealing, emphasizing the harmony of the steel skeleton within, as a body reveals the perfection of its bones. It had no other ornament to offer. It displayed nothing but the precision of its sharp angles, the modeling of its planes, the long streaks of its windows like streams of ice running down from the roof to the pavements. New Yorkers seldom looked at the Dana building. Sometimes a rare country visitor would come upon it unexpectedly in the moonlight and stop and wonder from what dream that vision had come. But such visitors were rare. The tenants of the Dana building said that they would not exchange it for any structure on earth. They appreciated the light, the air, the beautiful logic of the plan in their halls and offices. But the tenants of the Dana building were not numerous. No prominent man wished his business to be located in a building that looked like a warehouse. The Dana building had been designed by Henry Cameron. In the 1880s, the architects of New York fought one another for second place in their profession. No one aspired to the first. The first was held by Henry Cameron. Henry Cameron was hard to get in those days. He had a waiting list 2 years in advance. He designed personally every structure that left his office. He chose what he wished to build. When he built, a client kept his mouth shut. He demanded of all people the one thing he had never granted anybody, obedience. He went through the years of his fame like a projectile flying to a goal no one could guess. People called him crazy, but they took what he gave them, whether they understood it or not, because it was a building by Henry Cameron. At first, his buildings were merely a little different, not enough to frighten anyone. He made startling experiments once in a while, but people expected it, and one did not argue with Henry Cameron. Something was growing in him with each new building, struggling, taking shape, rising dangerously to an explosion. The explosion came with the birth of the skyscraper. When structures began to rise not in tier on ponderous tier of masonry, but as arrows of steel shooting upward without weight or limit, Henry Cameron was among the first to understand this new miracle and to give it form. He was among the first and the few who accepted the truth that a tall building must look tall. While architects cursed, wondering how to make a 20-story building look like an old brick mansion, while they used every horizontal device available in order to cheat it of its height, shrink it down to tradition, hide the shame of its steel, make it small, safe, and ancient, Henry Cameron designed skyscrapers in straight vertical lines, flaunting their steel and height. While architects drew friezes and pediments, Henry Cameron decided that the skyscraper must not copy the Greeks. Henry Cameron decided that no building must copy any other.